Elizabeth R., said that she just had the pleasure of opening a new exhibition at the Science Museum in London. BBC News.
And this is BBC Radio 4. Now here's Professor Kathy Willis, the Director of Science of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, with an omnibus edition of her new history of our changing relationship with plants. In Plants, From Roots to Riches.
This is one of my favourite views of Kew Gardens from above. I'm high up in Kew's treetops, 18 metres above the lawns and flowerbeds, on a walkway suspended between a series of futuristic-looking steel supports. Up here, I'm eyeball to eyeball with the business end of the tree, the leaves. This is where plant life and chemistry is at its most active. With me is Tony Kirkham, Kew's head of Arboretum. Tony, up here you can really see how much of the canopy is designed to catch light, can't you?
It's about branch structure,
yeah,
and how those lateral branches are coming off that trunk and pushing out to get maximum surface area of leaf to capture maximum sunlight. You know, I marvel all the time at the way that they grow, the way that they form. And often we look at trees for their attributes that they give us in a garden, maybe for, you know, for autumn colour, for leaf colour, for flower, for fruit. But actually, these simple species like the common beech or the common oak that we have around us here, that attributes for a reason, and it's to survive.
The key to this is a biomolecule found in almost all plants and whose structure was elucidated in the early 20th century. Such was its significance that in 1915, the Nobel Committee awarded the chemistry prize to the German organic chemist Richard Wilstatter, singling out his pioneering research in plant pigments, especially the green pigment chlorophyll.
By its property of making possible the assimilation of carbon dioxide under the influence of sunlight, and hence introducing the synthesis of organic substances in the green parts of the plant, chlorophyll possesses extraordinarily great biological significance and has an extremely important task to fulfil in the economy of nature.
Wilstatter's Nobel Prize was a symbolic moment. It united what for several centuries scientists in many different countries had been gradually piecing together, an understanding of what is essentially the fundamental building block of all life on Earth, the process by which plants use sunlight to turn water and carbon dioxide into the most basic sugar, glucose. Any history of this amazing chemical process tends to begin with Joseph Priestley, who in 1772 was the first to realise that gases are important. But that's to overshadow the remarkably contemporary observations made a century earlier by Stephen Hales, whose day job was Vicar of Teddington and who conducted his botanical researches in his spare time. Historian Jim Endersby.
He was very inspired by Newton and by Newton's mechanics to really take plants apart as if they were machines and to think about how they worked. He talked about the leaves as being the lungs of the plant. He understood that that was part of the mechanism too. But then he actually says, and may not light also, by freely entering the expanded surfaces of leaves and flowers,
contribute much to the ennobling of the principles of vegetables. For Sir Isaac Newton puts it as a very probable query. Are not gross bodies and light convertible into one another? And may not bodies receive much of their activity from the particles of light which enter their composition? The change of bodies into light, and of light into bodies, is very conformable to the course of nature, which seems delighted with transmutations.
Of course, Newton envisaged light as corpuscles, tiny little bodies that had some kind of physical or material quality to them. So the idea that bodies of one kind might be converted into bodies of another is easier to imagine in the 17th and early 18th century than the idea of energy, as we would now think of it, being converted into matter. So Hales makes these extraordinary breakthroughs and actually pulls all his work together into a book called Vegetable Statics, the kind of founding document of plant physiology. The great Julius von Sachs, who is always credited in the 19th century with being the inventor of proper laboratory botany, he says of vegetable statics, Hales may be said to have made his plants themselves speak.
Von Sachs, a German botanist from Breslau, had begun looking inside the plant itself. Developments in microscope technology and in the understanding of the cell allowed Sachs to observe that chlorophyll is not scattered all around the plant cells, but contained in green structures within the cell, which he called chloroplasts. In 1862, Sachs showed that these were involved in the production of tiny starch grains, which the plant then used as food. Sachs's seminal textbook of botany was translated into English in 1875 by the then assistant director of Kew Gardens, William Thiselton Dyer. Contained within the book was the celebrated formula memorised by generations of schoolchildren ever since. Carbon dioxide plus water plus the catalyst of light reacts to give glucose and oxygen. It wasn't until two decades later, in 1897, in yet another continent, America, that two plant scientists, Charles Barnes and Conway Macmillan, gave the process its name, photosynthesis. It was now clear where it occurred in the plant, its requirements and its limits. And when you know that, you can begin to manipulate it. Researchers found that controlling the amount of light and carbon dioxide could have a dramatic effect on the plant. The commercial implications were obvious. Tomato farmers growing crops in constant light could reduce a growing season by months, and increased levels of carbon dioxide were seen to improve size and yield. The impact of raised levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide on plants is often overlooked when we talk about climate change. For some plants, especially trees, this can represent good news, as it provides the plant with an increased ability to photosynthesize, grow, and store biomass. However, plant communities are also being challenged with drier and hotter climates in many areas. So how will plants respond to this cocktail of climate change? One way to determine this is to understand the different methods plants use to photosynthesize. Routinely, we learn at school what's known as the C3 pathway. This is where the first product of photosynthesis contains three carbon atoms. There are, however, other pathways, and one of particular interest to the challenges of current climate change is the C4 pathway. Jane Langdale is a professor in plant sciences at the University of Oxford, and she showed me a striking image of these two processes in action.
In the foreground here, you've got rice grown as a crop. The seedlings you're looking at were planted 42 days prior to this photo being taken. And in the background is maize that was planted at the same time. And the maize plants are much bigger.
Yeah, 50% bigger.
Yeah, maybe. Much greater biomass in the same time. And the maize plants are carrying out what we call C4 photosynthesis, and it's much more efficient, particularly in sort of hot climates like they are in the Philippines here. And essentially what those plants are doing is much more efficiently converting light into biomass. That's as a consequence of the C4 pathway that they're using, the photosynthetic pathway that they're using.
So we have at least two photosynthetic pathways in plants, C3 and C4. Interestingly, evolutionary scientists have now discovered that the C3 pathway is the ancient pathway, and one used by all plants until around 60 million years ago. At this point, evidence in the fossil record indicates the presence of plants containing the C4 pathway as well. This coincided with an interval in time when the climate became increasingly hot and arid. So how does this knowledge of these different pathways and their evolution then help us with growing crops, given our present-day climate challenges? One particularly ambitious programme addressing this is the C4 Rice Project. Its aim is to make rice, normally a C3 plant, into one that uses the C4 pathway with all its associated benefits of increased yield in a warmer and drier climate. This is far from straightforward, but as Jane Langdale explains, the key is to rectify a flaw that lies at the heart of photosynthesis, namely that in C3 plants, the enzyme known as rubisco that first binds carbon dioxide into the plant performs less well in warmer climates.
C3 plants are not very efficient because in addition to CO2 reacting with rubisco, oxygen does. And so there's this competition going on between oxygen and CO2. And in high temperatures, oxygen can win out. Right. And so therefore you reduce the efficiency with which CO2 is converted into sugars. So what C4 plants do is separate Rubisco from oxygen. And they do that by essentially having Rubisco compartmentalized in just one photosynthetic cell type that sits tightly around the veins in the center of the leaf. Whereas carbon dioxide is fixed by an oxygen-insensitive enzyme in cells that are closer to the edge of the leaf. And so what the C4 pathway is doing is acting like a turbocharger. It effectively takes carbon dioxide from the outer parts of the leaf, fixes it, and then shoves it into the inner parts of the leaf, where it's re-released and then fixed again by Rubisco. And that extra little turbocharge means that oxygen can't inhibit photosynthesis, and therefore it's much more efficient. So there's a whole bunch of different enzymes involved. And then, of course, add on top of that, I keep mentioning these two cell types, that means the leaf anatomy is completely different.
So you've got to change the architecture of the leaf and also the molecular pathways as well.
Yes.
And does the evolutionary record help you here? I mean, if it's happened before in the evolutionary record, can you look at the differences between the groups which have been C3 and then C4?
Yes, so that's one part of the project that is going on, is looking at global changes in the expression patterns of genes in C4 versus C3 plants to see if we can identify ones that are always switched on in C4 plants and never switched on in C3 plants, for example, giving us candidates for the sorts of things we might need to change. And the fact that C4 evolved multiple times in evolution is certainly something that gives us great hope. Mm. There must at least have been some sort of preconditioning event that essentially got a whole group of plants in a position whereby it was much easier to flick that switch to go from C3 to C4 than otherwise might have been.
If it works, the C4 rice project could increase rice yields by over 50%. Scientists have made considerable strides in understanding other C4 food crops like maize, sugar, sorghum and millet, and these advances will be crucial in allowing rice to join this group. This has to be one of the most exciting and potentially important strides in science to address the global challenge of feeding an ever-increasing population. Understanding the different biological pathways and how these differences are spread throughout the plant kingdom is giving scientists a significant insight into the long-term fate of plants in a changing climate. However, some plants seem to be able to adapt and survive more easily than others. And as we'll hear, it took a chance encounter with an evening primrose to explain why.
Multiple genes.
A single plant can exhibit many forms. Its ability to do so is its ticket to survival. If one form is susceptible to particular disease or environmental change, another may not be. Your chances of surviving and prospering as a species are greatly enhanced if you look at the world with many faces. In the case of plants, a particularly successful way of doing this is through gaining an additional set or sets of genetic material. This extraordinary phenomenon may also hold clues to one of the great botanical mysteries, why flowering plants evolved so rapidly around 130 million years ago. It was the German botanist Hugo de Vries who in 1903 was the first to write about the many faces of plants. De Vries, as you may remember, was one of those scientists who'd recently rediscovered the work of Gregor Mendel. And as a result, he'd begun to question Darwin's theories of evolution. De Vries became convinced that species must at some periods have evolved in sudden bursts, so-called discontinuous variation, rather than Darwin's theory of continuous, slow accumulation of genetic traits. An abandoned potato field outside the Dutch town of Hilversum seemed to provide him with the evidence he needed. A cluster of evening primrose had established itself as a gorgeous escapee from a local back garden. De Vries observed it attracted immediate attention, even from a distance. And as historian Jim Endersby explains, something else also caught his eye.
De Vries noticed that among these evening primroses there were new types. They were only subtly different from the parental types, but they were definitely distinct. And what was interesting about them was that they didn't interbreed with the old types. They remained stable from day one. De Vries talks about the fulfilment of all my hopes when he found these plants growing. There were no steps, there were no intermediate generations, there was no struggle for existence in the classic Darwinian sense. They just seemed to grow overnight. One of the varieties that De Vries had found, he called Oenothera lamarckiana gigas, the giant. And this one was, as you might expect, much bigger and stronger looking than the others. And as researchers gradually figured out what was happening, they discovered what had happened was that the chromosomes in the plant had been duplicated. Normally, of course, a plant, the pollen and the ovule have a single set of chromosomes. They're called haploid. When they fuse to form a zygote, the beginning of a new plant, they end up with two sets of chromosomes. They're diploid, one set from mum, one set from dad. And each cell in the plant will have two sets of those chromosomes, one from each parent. These ones have three, four sets of chromosomes.
Quite literally, the amount of genetic material in the plant cell nucleus multiplies by a factor of three or four. It's a curious phenomenon, and it's earned itself a curious name, polyploidy. The word means many forms. It happens when something goes awry during the process of cell division, either sexually or asexually. This results in an additional set or sets of chromosomes. In practice, this means that within one generation, a new species can develop. In animals, these abnormalities are usually extremely rare, but in plants, they're common, and it's estimated that 60 to 70% of flowering plants have resulted from polyploidy events. As so often, different scientists approached a problem from different directions at the same time. At about the same time as De Vries was beginning to ponder this strange occurrence, polyploidy produced an intriguing case right here at Kew. In 1900, gardener Frank Garrett noticed a mysterious primula hybrid amid seedlings in one of the garden's greenhouses. This appeared to be a new plant, the offspring of two very different types of primrose, one from the snowy mountains of the Himalayas, the other from the sandy wastes of Arabia.
This new type, which is christened Primula quensis, the Kew primrose, very attractive, unfortunately completely sterile. Now the enterprising gardener goes back to the parent stocks, figures out which ones they must have been, and manages to create more of these. And in the process of creating them, he finds a few that are fertile. They actually produce fertile flowers and they produce seed, so you can grow these. A number of women, Lettice Digby, Caroline Pellew, Florence Durham, several of whom are working with Bateson at Cambridge, one of the first geneticists in Britain, they work on these plants and unravel the mechanism that allows them to become fertile. And Digby in particular figures out that this is another case of polyploidy. And when she publishes her first report on this, she cites the work on Oenothera as a parallel case. So lots of people are interested in this precisely because it seems to offer another mechanism of speciation, another way that new kinds of plants come into existence. And of course, they're very attractive, these new primulas, so they have a gardening interest as well.
One of the consequences of being a polyploid is that the multiplication of the genome results in a greater store of genetic variability. The advantages of this can be seen in the tobacco plant family Nicotiana. It has 75 species and a high frequency of polyploidy, giving an insight into how this peculiarity can contribute to evolutionary success, often in challenging conditions. Mark Chase, keeper of Kew's Jodrell Laboratory, explains.
In the species of Nicotiana that we've been studying, the really interesting ones are the ones that are found now in Australia. The greatest species diversity is found right around Ayers Rock, where you can find 12 of these species. It's just incredible. You go out into these dry areas, you can't see any vegetation except little scrubby thorny shrubs and things like this, and then you'll see this leafy green flowering tobacco plant sitting there in the midst of this really arid environment, and there's no other plants around there like that. These are really specialized in this, but this is one of the things that we think is a benefit of being a polyploid, is they can do these incredible things that the diploids, the progenitors, the parents, couldn't do.
Because of this multiplication of genetic material, polyploidy plants often have bigger cells, resulting in, for example, bigger pollen grains and seeds. These features, especially combined with laborious chromosome counts, were used to detect polyploidy. Then in 1983, a process known as flow cytometry began to be used for the rapid analysis of plant cells. typically 5,000 nuclei per sample can be analysed in just a few minutes. As Ilya Lech, research scientist in the Jodrell Laboratory at Kew, describes, this technique is a huge improvement.
Here's an example of a run that we did when we were looking at ephedra, one of the non-flowering seed plants. This sample here, actually, which we measured yesterday, has about five times as much DNA as we have in each of our nuclei in humans, which perhaps is intriguing in its own right. But, and this is a tetraploid. We were running it to see what ploidy level it was, and we know from the amount of DNA it's a tetraploid. So we can go out to a population of one species and sample, say, 100 individuals, come back, run them on the flow cytometer, and see what diversity of ploidy is there even within a species. And it's been really enlightening, actually. Because we can do this, because we have the speed that we can process lots of samples, the studies are certainly showing that there's a much greater diversity of ploidy even within a species than was really hitherto expected based on chromosome counting, which was a very slow process. So it's been amazing to find this.
Rapid advances in new technology such as flow cytometry could help address one of evolution's greatest mysteries. Why, so soon after appearing in the fossil record about 130 million years ago, did flowering plants or higher plants suddenly explode into the bewildering diversity of species with their equally bewildering range of reproductive techniques? Showy magnolia-style blooms, multi-petal blossoms fertilised by bees, or plants that cast their pollen to the winds. Almost all the flowering plant families that we presently have around us diversified during this interval in time.
It may be that we can tie this burst of diversification to a polyploid event. And it makes sense, again, that this is what would spur this kind of process into happening. We have circumstantial evidence that there was a round of polyploidy and there was a really rapid diversification of these major lineages more or less around the same time. Given that it was only a window of 10 million years, it's really hard to be precise when you're dealing with something that's that far in the past and of such a short duration. But there are people that are working on this quite hard to try to pin this down so we can get a cause and effect.
Many of our crop species, for instance wheat, maize, sugarcane, are polyploid, either through selective breeding or as a result of an earlier polyploidy event. So as we discover more about ploidy, it could be that we learn even more about its wider impact on interactions within an ecosystem.
Probably one of the interesting implications is the fact that although you may not be able to necessarily see visually what ploidy levels you might have in a population, certainly, for example, the insects are capable of distinguishing between individuals with different ploidy levels. There aren't many studies at the moment, but the limited ones show, for example, in some species that pollinators may preferentially pollinate only the tetraploids or may only preferentially pollinate the diploids. So in a mixed population with different ploidy levels, even within a species, this will affect the ecological interactions, and that will have a knock-on effect into functioning of the ecosystem. But there aren't that many studies yet, but I think it's something perhaps which needs to be taken on board much more seriously. Now we know the frequency with which there is this diversity of ploidy even within a species.
So understanding this strange phenomenon, polyploidy, which caught the eye of the first geneticists, is something that may hold the keys to the evolution of flowering plants, understanding plant-insect interactions in ecosystems, and quality and quantity of some of our most stable food sources. This is not simply a matter of pure research. Its practical implications are all around us, and as we'll hear in future episodes, may provide resilience to future climate and disease outbreaks.
Battling bark and beetle.
In London's National Gallery hangs one of the nation's favourite paintings. The Hay Wain, painted by John Constable in 1821, depicts a rural scene. A wagon fords a stream, and in the background a row of elegant elms stands sentinel. England is green and pleasant, and all's right with the world. But Constable knew, when he painted it, that scenes like this were already under threat. The Industrial Revolution was taking hold. Urbanisation and transportation were poised to change England's predominantly agricultural way of life forever. What Constable didn't know was that the increased movement of people and products would change nature itself. In 1910, elms like the one in the Heywain began to die. They were under attack across Europe from a fungus spread by a beetle. Tony Kirkham, head of Kew's Arboretum, recalls witnessing the impact of Dutch elm disease at its peak in Kew Gardens in the late 1970s.
I remember looking out of the School of Horticulture where I was a student and seeing the last elm being felled. The tree lost all its dignity, and that really sunk home to me that I was never, ever going to be familiar with the elm.
And how many trees did Kew lose?
Over a period of 10 years, about 200 elms. And we had a really good elm collection here, and some iconic trees on the main orangery lawn and near the main gate and where the grass garden is today. I can still see them there now.
By the end of the First World War, the disease had already become well established across Belgium, the Netherlands and parts of northern France. Theories abounded about the cause. Was it drought, gas poisoning from World War I, a bacterium or canker disease? For the next 15 years, seven Dutch scientists, all women, tried to find the real culprit. One of the seven, graduate student B. Schwartz, realised that a fungus she called Graphium ulmi was killing the trees, but very few people believed her. Then Christine Biesman repeated and expanded Schwartz's experiment. The original studies were vindicated. The Dutch women had their culprit, and the disease, perhaps rather unfairly, gained its name, Dutch elm disease. But whilst the Dutch women provided vital information, unfortunately they couldn't provide a cure. As the Times newspaper records, by the 1930s, it had marched across the Channel to Britain.
The report of the Forestry Commission on Elms Disease makes cheerless reading, for it confirms observations of those who have watched the progress of this plague since its presence in Britain was first detected on some trees in Hertfordshire in 1927. Skeletons of trees are disconcertingly numerous. In the absence of a systematic survey, for which there seems neither authority, funds or machinery, the disease appears to be spreading, nor apparently has it any respect for remedies. Till science comes to the rescue, tree owners must stand by whilst the disease spreads at a disturbing rate.
This is the language of an epidemic. By the 1940s, the fungus had killed between 10 and 40% of elm trees in several European countries. Then it appeared to die down. Tom Peace, who monitored the spread of the disease across the UK on behalf of the Forestry Commission, wrote in 1960,
"Unless it completely changes its present trend of behaviour, it will never bring about the disaster once considered imminent."
Sadly, Peace was quickly proved wrong. In the late 1960s, the fungus was superseded by a more aggressive strain of Dutch elm disease. This made its way into Britain on infested elm logs and was carried by two beetle compatriots, the European elm bark beetle Scolitis multistratus and the large elm bark beetle Scolitis scolitus. Once again, Dutch elm disease began a fast-paced march across the countryside. Attracted to stressed or dead elmwood, the beetles tunnel into the bark and form galleries in which they lay their eggs. When these hatch, the larvae feed off the inner bark and sapwood. If the tree is infected with fungus, it produces sticky spores in the larval galleries. When the larvae emerge as adult beetles, they carry the spores onto the healthy trees on which they feed. So within a decade, two-thirds of Britain's 30 million elms were lost. The disease particularly favoured the English elm.
Well, we think that it came from Asia, and there are probably about two or three different species of Dutch elm disease. And they've hybridised, and then you get this hybrid vigour. And the disease makes a beeline for the xylem cells. And there are two schools of thought about what actually kills the tree. One is that the fungi blocks the xylem cells and stops the movement of water, so basically it cuts off its water supply.
So it goes into drought, does it?
Drought mode.
Yes.
But the other school of thought is that the tree, to defend itself, blocks the xylem cells to stop the fungal infection from moving through the trees. And that makes sense because, you know, trees have a remarkable ability to what we call compartmentalise and protect themselves. So the first symptoms were yellowing of leaves. Second symptom was, and this was the classic that we were taught at college to identify it from general stress, was shepherd's crooking. So the very tips of the young branches, they curled over like a shepherd's crook, and that was basically wilting, those young shoots wilting. And then if you had any suspicion that that was Dutch elm disease, if you cut through a piece about pencil thickness with your secateurs, there was brown staining in the cross section. And then very quickly the leaves dropped off and the tree senesced, and that was it.
And there's no cure to it, or there's no one's found?
No, there are no. We tried all sorts of injection methods, fungicides, insecticides. We didn't really know what we were controlling. Mm. Were we controlling the vector? Were we controlling the disease? So two totally different types of biocide. Nothing really worked, and probably most trees were killed because they were girdled by multiple injections around the base.
Up until the early 1990s, Dutch elm was probably the only major disease to affect trees in the UK. However, since then, new threats have emerged, including diseases in many of our familiar trees, including ash, alder and horse chestnut. Why this sudden increase? Two possible contenders are climate change and ease of movement of people and plants across borders. But are there practical ways to mitigate the spread of such diseases?
You would hope that lessons have been learned. I think one of the big issues for me is that we lost lots of elms in streets and parks because we had this thing of monoculture. So the whole street was planted with elms, and overnight the whole street went. However, you know, I'm still seeing monocultural planting today, so everything the same. And I would like to see far more mixing rather than matching. So that if we do have one disease, then it kills that tree, the tree goes, but we still have a landscape with different species and cultivars intact. The other thing is stricter biosecurity. There are a lot of diseases and pests out there still waiting to come into this country. And prevention is better than cure. And if we can prevent them coming in, then we don't have to control them. But we've got to be ready so that when they come, we can react and respond and eradicate, but prevent them coming in the first place.
Ironically, the main replacement for lost elms in the English landscape has been ash. And ash has itself now fallen victim to the latest disease to hitch a ride on incoming nursery stocks. Ash dieback is caused by the fungus Chelara fraxinea. Trees were first reported to be dying from the disease in Poland in 1992. Inevitably, it spread. By 2012, it had reached the UK in a consignment of infected trees sent from the Netherlands to a nursery in Buckinghamshire. As of May 2014, it had been found in 646 sites in the UK. The disease particularly favours the European ash and the narrow-leaved ash, causing leaves to drop and the crown to die back, hence its name, ash dieback. Mindful of the Dutch elm devastation, a UK task force has been set up to address the disease. They've suggested a number of initiatives, including a plant passport scheme and increased knowledge sharing across the EU, so-called epidemiological intelligence. And part of the solution could also come from Kew's Millennium Seed Bank. This is part of a wider project to assemble the UK's first genetically comprehensive tree seed collection, as Paul Smith, head of the Millennium Seed Bank, explains.
What we're doing actively now is going and collecting ash trees, seeds from ash trees, right across the UK from 24 different seed zones. And we know that those ash trees are genetically different in those different parts of the United Kingdom. What we don't know at this point is whether any of them have natural resistance to ash dieback. But once we have the seeds in the bank, we will be in a position to test that material to see whether it has resistance to that particular disease, so that we can plant new cohorts that have resistance to that particular disease or pest. There are groups currently working on trying to understand what the genetic basis of that resistance is. And once we've identified the genes that are responsible, it should be possible to design a very simple genetic test. So we simply pull the seed out of the bank, test it, and if we find natural resistance there, we have the information, the exact information about where that seed was collected from the very tree that that seed was collected. And we can go back to the mother tree, collect more seeds, and we use those seeds to, as I say, plant ash trees back into the landscape.
Successive waves of diseases like Dutch elm and ash dieback have radically altered the way we view our landscape. They've affected everything from street planting to our attitude towards invasive pests. But Tony Kirkham is optimistic that the current threat posed by ash dieback is likely to be easier to control.
Dutch elm disease went down the hedgerows and wiped out the trees very, very quickly. Because they were all clones, they were all the same, because they propagate themselves vegetatively through suckers, and that's how they spread down the hedgerows. Fortunately, the ash isn't in the same boat, because the ash is propagated sexually by seed. So there will be lots of genotypes of ash across the UK, and they will all have different responses to ash dieback, and there will be resistance within the population of ash. So I think we'll be pleasantly surprised that the ash will be able to overcome.
Because they've got much greater genetic variability
exactly.
within these populations,
yeah.
right?
I hope so.
Nowadays, we hear a lot about genetic diversity. By the time the first wave of destruction of Dutch elm disease had been recognised, just after the First World War, new ideas were emerging about using this diversity to achieve practical solutions to problems not just of disease, but also of feeding the rapidly expanding post-war population. But what is the best way to harness nature's genetic riches, and where do you find them? It took the ingenious insight of a Russian botanist to pinpoint where to look.
Hunt for diversity.
As we've moved across the globe, we've carried plant life with us. Seeds are small, resilient and easy to carry, and colonists and invaders have taken their native crop plants all over the world. In some cases, this makes it difficult to know where and when the original wild ancestors of many of our domesticated plants first evolved. But we can get on their trail by looking at where their wild relatives grow today. The pioneer in this field was a botanist and crop breeder, sometimes called the Leonardo da Vinci of agriculture, Nikolai Vavilov.
In nature, there is a gigantic store of varieties as yet unused in the world agricultural industry. For instance, numerous forms of field plants, which the science and practice of the developed countries have been unaware of, in the regions of southwestern Asia, Western Asia and the Transcaucasus. Cereal grasses of Asia and the Transcaucasus are of great interest from a practical point of view. They are characterized by non-shattering, drought resistance, excellent vitreous grain, tolerance to soil quality and immunity to many parasitic fungi.
Vavilov was interested not only in the history of botany for its own sake, but in the potential of these species as a future economic and food resource. These qualities he identified are important factors in planning what to grow today, given the increasing demands for food and pressure on the growing environment. A further pressure point in our system of feeding ourselves on the land is that 80% of our calories comes from just 12 crop species. The new all-powerful monocrops have their risks. In this programme, I'll be looking at how Vavilov's ideas developed new agricultural awareness and how he possibly did more than anyone else in history to help us understand where our food comes from. He also has cemented the idea of genetic diversity as a necessary science. We've never needed his ideas more. Nikolai Vavilov was born in Moscow in 1887. In the early years of the 20th century, he went on more than 180 expeditions and field trips, collecting and studying plants in their wild habitats. His crucial insight was to recognise that these wild relatives of crops represent important, possibly unique pools of genetic variability that could help successful and sustainable plant breeding for human use. Dorian Fuller, Professor of Archaeobotany at University College London, takes up the story.
In some ways, he was one of the first ethnobotanists. So he did a lot of time talking to local farmers in Tajikistan and Afghanistan and sort of far-flung parts of the Soviet Union, looking at what they did with their crops, why they valued certain varieties. And he was an early student of modern genetics, of the principles of Gregor Mendel. And so he thought that using those principles and using these wide varieties of land races and wild relatives, you could find genes that would improve crop varieties, improve resistance to disease, improve resistance to climatic stress. And so by gathering a huge amount of genetic diversity, they could work through that material and find useful traits and improve agriculture and prevent future famines.
The famine he'd witnessed as a child gave him the drive and determination to develop a successful scientific defence against such terrible suffering. His search for genetic diversity and origins was far from just an academic exercise.
He was an evolutionary thinker, and he reasoned that places that had a longer history of agriculture or a longer history of a species having been there, so the wild forms, had more time for evolution to have created diversity and diverse adaptations. I think his view of evolution was very much gradualist in that genes didn't change very often, but once there were genetic adaptations, you could essentially find those from places in the wild or where there'd been a long history of agriculture and there'd been more time for adaptations to accumulate. So you could find those genes with those adaptations and then breed them into modern crops. And so that immediately meant that he had an interest in the history of agriculture and domestication of crops and finding where that history was longer, so where that evolutionary process of adaptation was longer. And he collected widely across the Soviet Union. By the time he was in his 20s, he'd been across many parts of Asia, essentially, the Soviet Union. He collected crops in Tajikistan and Ukraine and various parts of the Russian world.
His travels in Asia provided his big idea that each type of cultivated plant crop originated in a particular place, and that place can be identified because the greatest variation in wild relatives is still found there. These places, he thought, are both centres of diversity and centres of origin.
For instance, there turned out to be two centres for barley, in eastern Asia and in eastern Africa. For flax, in North Africa and southeastern Asia. The centres for crops and the centres of origin of cultivated plants turned out to be located not along the valleys of the great rivers, as I thought before, but on the contrary, in the mountainous regions.
Agriculture tends to favour the best food varieties. This, in turn, works against diversity. Vavilov became increasingly concerned about the potential loss of locally adapted varieties, and in 1920 he opened the world's first seed bank. It was based at the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences in St. Petersburg, where he was the director from 1920 to 1940. His plan was ambitious but essentially simple: to collect all useful germplasm with potential from across the Soviet Union, classify it, and use it in a national plant breeding effort.
Where's your first collecting trip going to be?
We'll target an area in the north of Lisbon.
Kew's Millennium Seed Bank at Wakehurst Place in West Sussex aims to collect, store and assess the quality and germination patterns of the original genetic progenitors of our domestic crops. In effect, it's the same thing as Vavilov was doing a century ago. The MSB has around 60 partners worldwide who each have detailed expert knowledge of their own area.
We'll be collecting one of the progenitors of the cultivated carrot.
So we end up with specimens and examples of all the useful wild cousins of our domesticated plants, maps of where to find them, and information about how and when to collect them. Head of the MSB is Paul Smith.
We're looking for characteristics that will confer resilience, if you like, that give us options for adaptation. So those could include disease resistance, drought tolerance. And of course, the biggest worry we have at the moment is climate change. We don't know how that's going to affect different crops or different parts of the world, and therefore it makes sense to us to collect and conserve as wide a range of genetic diversity as possible.
For Vavilov and his ambition, the tragedy was the times he lived in. By the 1940s, his institute had been taken over by the crackpot pseudo-scientific ideas of Stalin's favoured scientist, Lysenko. Vavilov battled to fly the flag for Mendelian genetics as the basis for crop improvement, but it was against the neo-Lamarckian theories of Lysenko, and as so many thinkers and intellectuals found to their cost, free thought was no defence in Stalin's Russia. Vavilov was arrested and imprisoned. But by one of those miracles of the human spirit which run through the history of the worst of times, the seed bank survived the siege of Leningrad. A group of scientists at the Vavilov Institute boxed up seeds, moved them to the basement, and took shifts protecting them in the pitch dark and sub-zero temperatures far below the frozen streets of the starving city.
His seed bank of course, was large stockpiles of grain and seed potatoes and, you know, wheat, barley, oats, both to store as germplasm, as genetic material, and also for experimental research, so not to be eaten. And his staff very valiantly hid and protected these crops in their little centers and prevented both themselves and their neighbors from eating these things when people were in the streets starving to death.
But they refused to eat the seeds in the collection. They chose torment, and in some cases death, in order to preserve Vavilov's gene bank.
There was very little interest, as I understand it, from the Russian authorities at that time, from Stalin's government, to protect these. They didn't see these as useful, though they hid the art of the Hermitage, for example, where the Nazis couldn't find it, but they took no interest in the seed bank. The Nazis, on the other hand, were very interested in the seed bank because they knew that it had all this genetic material so that they could improve German agriculture and crops, so they were very keen on capturing it, which they didn't manage to do, but they got very close.
Vavilov's death provided one tiny twisted irony amongst all the insanity and barbarism. Incarcerated in Saratov prison, he died of the one thing he'd spent his life trying to prevent: starvation. Science cannot succeed in bettering human life when politics fails. Remarkably, the gene bank was saved, and staff at the Institute worked out an elaborate plan to re-sow and restore the viability of the whole collection, providing the basis for one of a network of seed banks which today carry on Vavilov's work across the globe. His institute still holds one of the world's largest collections of genetic plant material. Like many of the best scientific ideas, Vavilov's theory combines simplicity, beauty and utility. His ideas have been modified and refined, of course, and it may not always make sense to speak of the centres of origin, as Vavilov did, but it's certainly still essential to understand that crops have centres of diversity. For historians, this diversity remains a crucial clue in delving into crop evolution. For those charged with working out how to feed the world, the future of our food depends on it. Vavilov's vision of plants, genetic diversity and seed banking is now needed more than ever.
We have been prompted by some of the most pressing practical problems in our large-scale agriculture. It was necessary to master exhaustively the whole initial varietal potentialities of the world, as well as to learn about the nearest wild relatives of our useful plants. Life is short. One must hurry. Botanical medicine.
Writing in 1636, the herbalist John Gerard told his readers, "The juice of grass mixed with honey and the powder of southernwood taken in drink killeth worms in children." Later in the century, John Robarts, Cornish nobleman and fellow of the Royal Society, scribbled down a cure for epilepsy and vertigo using mistletoe. And botanist William Coles and others spread the doctrine of signatures, a folk medicine from the Middle Ages based along the lines, nature makes each growing thing according to its curative benefit. According to this doctrine, damaged parts of the body can be healed by plants which look like them. For example, lungwort, Pulmonaria officinalis, was prescribed for pulmonary disease because the leaves resembled the outline of lungs. These medicinal uses of plants were part of a long and distinguished tradition going back to at least the ancient Sumerians 5,000 years ago. Pliny wrote about it, and the Roman physician Dioscorides wrote a pharmacopoeia of herbs and medicines between 50 and 70 AD, which was circulated enthusiastically around Europe for the next millennium. So it had been known for thousands of years that plants have healing and curative properties, but what was still unknown were the chemical compounds responsible. In 1947, however, science finally found one of the plant world's most powerful weapons against human disease: alkaloids.
They usually have striking, sometimes sensational, physiological effects. Among them are quinine, cocaine and atropine, all of which have important medicinal qualities. Plants containing alkaloids have generally drawn the attention of primitive peoples, and in the cases where they are met with in countries with ancient culture, the knowledge of their properties often goes back to prehistoric age.
That was part of the citation speech for the award of the 1947 Nobel Prize for Chemistry to the British scientist Sir Robert Robinson. The citation went on to praise his investigations on plant products of biological importance, especially the alkaloids. Professor Monique Simmons is a plant chemist in the Jodrell Laboratory at Kew, and as she explains, the alkaloids are a large family of chemicals which plants have evolved for some very specific reasons.
Most alkaloids in plants are characterised by being bitter, and that's why they're often associated with being anti-herbivory, because insects don't really like bitter plants. It's thought possibly to have an effect on the regulation of plant growth, but for us it's of interest because of its medicinal properties. You've got your morphine. There was more interest in morphine for pain control, and you also got the increased use in things like nicotine, which is an alkaloid, and caffeine, another alkaloid that are common to everyday purposes. There was also advance in analytical techniques that enabled us to be able to see a little bit more inside, you might say, plants and identify and isolate the active compounds.
One of Britain's first encounters with this powerful group of drugs occurred right here at Kew. As you may remember, Kew had been receiving plant specimens from all over the world since the late 18th century and had been developing their commercial and research potential. Medicine, in the broad sense, had always been part of this effort. Bark from trees often provided the basis for crude drugs, and one in particular was beginning to show itself effective in the treatment of fevers, especially those resulting from malaria. This was the scourge of European imperialists, with ambitions in the tropics, and caused considerable difficulties nearer to home too. The work of Charles Dickens is full of families of mudlarks squelching out their insanitary existence on the swampy tidal fringes of the Thames and the Wash around Kent, Norfolk and London. These areas, by the mid-19th century, were malaria-ridden. So how could this scourge be held at bay? The answer was to be found in the bark of a tree high up on the eastern slopes of the Andes in South America, cinchona, containing a compound which targets the plasmodium parasites that cause malaria. Cinchona is a genus containing 25 species and yet growing in a hostile and remote environment for the 19th century European explorers. In these early days, identifying good cinchona bark was a mixture of skill and guesswork. But when whole trees and seeds started reaching Europe, making proper species identification possible, much of the chancy nature of the process was removed. In 1820, the French chemists Pierre-Joseph Pelletier and Joseph Caventou isolated quinine from cinchona bark in the laboratory. A new type of scientist appeared, equally able to handle botanical and chemical data. Perhaps the most distinguished of these was John Elliott Howard, FRS of Howard & Sons, whose collections account for over half of the Kew's 1,000 specimens of cinchona bark in the Economic Botany Collection. The curator is Mark Nesbitt.
Quinine sulfate is one of the four main alkaloids that are effective in treating malaria, which are contained within cinchona. And this bottle of powder here is a kind of really important symbol of that ability to extract the alkaloids and then to have standardised medicines of the kind that we might recognise today. John Elliott Howard is a very critical figure in that he brought together a good understanding of which species of tree contained which quinine alkaloids and in which amount. That enabled both higher quality manufacturing at the European end, but it also enabled plant explorers to then go and target species of cinchona for collection in the wild for transplantation.
And did he then start to grow cinchona in this country?
Yes, John Elliott Howard was a great collector. We have his collection of around about 800 bark specimens here at Kew, but he also collected living plants. He grew them in North London. They had glass houses, so he was able to actually observe the trees and analyse bark from trees that he could actually see. So he kind of broke through this geographical barrier. We had botanists and chemists in London or Paris, and the cinchona trees in the Andes.
The dream, however, was to establish cinchona in places under British control. Kew, as usual, was in the forefront. Its plant hunters were sent out to gather seeds and identify the best areas to exploit them. The collector Charles Ledger brought back some beauties in 1865. But for once, Kew took its eye off the commercial ball. Ledger offered Kew his seeds. Kew's directors said they had enough. So Ledger sold his seeds to the Dutch, who went on to huge success in the production of quinine. Underpinned by a mixture of botany and chemistry, the search goes on. Today, local knowledge and traditional culture, both historical and contemporary, continue to provide vital clues for those trying to find and identify medicinal plants. Such leads are crucial when it's estimated that only about 20% of the world's known plant species have been investigated for new compounds with potential medicinal properties. But if we can now synthesise these compounds, why bother to go to the plant kingdom at all?
We still need plants for as ideas because they're real chemical factories. The skeletons that we identify in plants for new drugs is often much wider than we would do as an organic chemist. And of course, most of those compounds have some function. They've evolved by the plant to have biological activity, and that really is a key. The trick, though, is to identify them. And I think the other trick is, you could say, it's been enhanced with our knowledge of things like traditional Chinese medicine. They never use one plant. When we now go to the doctor, we're given a cocktail of drugs. The trick, I think, for us is to identify the cocktail of compounds in the plant that actually are associated with its medicinal properties.
Our ancestors were onto something. There is an untold richness of medicinal resources still out there, not just in the tropics, but closer to home as well. Robinson's pioneering work in 1947 was part of a fascination with the chemical properties of plants. And it's this understanding of the molecular compounds that plants produce that would lead to transformation in our ability to predict plant responses to environmental risk and ecological scarcity. Key research areas that would come to dominate plant sciences in the second half of the 20th century.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Cathy Willis. The readers were Clive Haywood and Ian Redford. The producer was Adrian Washbourne. And to find out more about the plants featured in the series, just go to the Plants from Roots to Riches website, where you can also download the series as a podcast. Now, before we join David Eads for the World Tonight, let's have a look at the weather forecast. Frequent showers and strong winds will continue across western Scotland, with severe gales affecting coastal areas. It'll be less windy elsewhere, with variable cloud and sunny spells. However, there'll be some showers too, and these will be mainly in the west. Rain will affect northwestern parts on Sunday and Monday. This rain will be heavy and persistent across northwest Scotland, with some very large rainfall totals building up. Elsewhere, there'll be variable cloud and sunny spells on both days. However, a few showers will continue in the west. It'll be windy in the north with gales, and these will be locally severe in the northwest. On 92 to 95 FM, 198 Longwave, on digital radio and online. This is BBC Radio 4.